This is a Collider.com audio interview.
So what attracted you to this project?
You.
Okay, I'm going to go there. No, what did I say? Are you interested in the newspaper business? I mean, and the integrity behind it?
I mean, it's even more personal than that. I'd like to know that when I read the paper in the morning, it's telling me something that actually happened.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that the vast majority of journalists want the same thing. I think it's amazing to me how there's not that I know of anyway, some rule book for everybody, but everybody has the same standards of integrity, and that's why so many lately, I think of these unfortunate slips have come to light because editors and I guess editors have been watching out for that, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's important to journalism, but it's important to the rest of us even more so.
Was your character based on? Must be based on a real person.
I don't know. I kind of doubt it. I doubt that the editor is based on anybody real. I mean, I think that was invented by in the course of writing it for the purpose of telling the story. I think. I don't know. Nobody told me that it was based on anybody real. But you know, as you know, the Mohringer story really happened.
Mm-hmm.
And not exactly the way it's in the movie. I think it's heightened a little in the movie, but mm-hmm. I mean, he's a really good writer. He wrote this best-selling memoir. It came out the same year that my memoir came out.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and
you probably outsold him though.
I don't know. We both did very well.
But what struck me about Josh's character.
No, let's talk about my book.
The reason he does the end run around you,
yeah,
is that he knows that you would ask. You're his editor. You would ask him some tough questions.
Oh, that's interesting.
Not,
yeah,
which he had not answered because a lot of us who are journalists, halfway through, we were saying he's got no corroboration. He's relying entirely on what the Sam Jackson.
You could see it coming, sure.
He's been told that he has to talk to the son, and that really hasn't happened.
Mm-hmm.
And he is more comfortable sending it the magazine route than sending it past you because you would.
Well, why wouldn't the magazine have done that, I wonder?
Because I don't think magazines are as.
Oh.
Unless it's something like the New Yorker or Time with its fast fact check is going to be as scrupulous.
Yeah.
Well, that researcher he used wasn't scrupulous either.
I know, it's very interesting. I noticed that you mentioned two magazines, Time and the New Yorker, who, when they did pieces on me, called me up about the tiniest facts.
Oh, really? Right.
Yeah.
That's really good for them.
Yeah. But so did TV Guide.
They're scared of you.
But I have to tell you that you look very much at home in the Calgary Herald newsroom, which I'm very familiar with.
Oh, it's familiar to you?
Oh, yes.
That's good. But have you worked at that paper?
I worked for the Herald for some years.
Oh, that's nice. Well, that was, you know, what's interesting about that is that many of the people, if not all of them, I don't know, that you see in those cubicles were real reporters who, while we were shooting, continued to work on their stories.
Okay.
They were on the phone and they were, they didn't even look up at us. You know, they were just doing their work. And it's very interesting how quiet it is in a newsroom. I noticed that when I went through the New York Times, too. It's not like, I think it was different in the old days.
Teletypes are not gone. That's what's the
whole thing. Typewriters.
Typewriters are gone,
mm-hmm.
and there are no copy boys running around with actual pieces of paper in their hands. You know?
Well, did you on your character? Did you think that he was ever threatened by Eric, or he really didn't think he was very good?
I think he thought he could be good.
Okay.
And I. You know, you always see the character from the character's point of view. Probably, I mean, that's the best way to do it. And so I understand that he had to get a section out every day. And he had to fill the space and fill it as well as he could. But if all this guy could do was fill the space, he needed that too.
Right.
And he put in a quick word of letting him know he could be better, but he wasn't going to waste any time on it.
Practically. Did you base it on anyone that you knew, an authority figure?
No, it's really in the writing. It's there in the writing. But I did. I have a lot of friends who are journalists, and they all happened to be at. Many of them happened to be at dinner one night. And I realized that there were like 150 years of journalism in the room. So I just asked them a few questions. They had some ideas, but little things. And I talked it over with Rod, and he said, "Yeah, that's good." But mainly our advisor on the set every day was Rod, because he spent years in newsrooms himself.
How was it working with him as a director?
I like him very much. I like working with him very much. We were very free and open with each other, you know. About, you know, he'd just say, "Well, why don't you try it this way?" And that was easy to do, because he's very attentive. You know, he sees what's going on, he hears what's happening. It seems odd to praise a director for that, but there are many directors who actually don't see what's going on. Mm-hmm. They're busy thinking about the shot, and what happens in the shot is just a certain amount of content that you provide, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not the best way to get the best out of the actors.
You know, last year you were involved in one of my all-time favorite hours on TV, mm-hmm. which was the ice cream eating sequence in the presidential kitchen.
Yeah. That really stands out in a lot of people's minds. Maybe it was the ice cream, but I mean the combination of that particular discussion and ice cream, and the idea that there was a secret cache of ice cream in the basement of the White House. I think those three ideas really combined. What was it that made it stick in your mind?
Well, all that, plus the way you and Martin Sheen played it. Political adversaries from the opposite.
Yes, right.
Of the spectrum.
Right. Yeah.
And you had some common interest, starting with ice cream.
But yeah.
I mean, you don't need to work these days, so what makes you work?
Oh, well, I love getting better. I try to get better all the time. And you can't get better staying at home playing with the computer. Although I get better at that while I do that. That's a real pleasure for me, and I'd like to see how long I can keep doing that, you know, and not lose my energy while I do it. And the better I get, the more interesting stuff I get to do. So I like that. It's really nice.
TV, film, stage, and writing, you've done it also. Is there one that you'd like to do more of than the other?
No, I really love it that the writing has hit, you know, and that I'm able to do that. Because it's really a perfect thing for me. The second book is coming out on September 4th.
Oh, what's it called?
It's called Things I Overheard While Talking to Myself.
Where'd you get that?
So what is the thrust?
I can't resist these cockeyed titles.
What is the thrust of it?
It's me trying to figure out the meaning of my life, and which is a kind of a... It seems odd at this point in my life. But I almost died about 3 years ago, too. I forget how many years ago that was. But everything that's happened to me since then has been a bonus. And like a lot of people who get a second chance, I'm really interested to know how to get the most juice out of everything, that's out of all the time that's ahead of me, and part of that is trying to figure out what would make it seem really meaningful to me, really, because it's a weird word. I mean, it's a crazy quest. There's no, I can tell you right now, there's no end to it. It's a dumb thing to look for. But so the book is kind of funny and kind of heartfelt at the same time.
Heart memoir, heart philosophy.
Well, search more than philosophy, but you know, kind of quest. And it's, and I go back over things, the talking to myself part is I go back over things that I've said, you know, over the years I've given advice to kids, to my own kids, my grandkids, graduating classes. And I go back and listen to that again and see how it applies to me and if I've done what I asked them to do, you know. Yeah, and so what I started to say was, and thanks for asking me about this, but it's really fun for me to have a book come out because then I go around the country talking about it, you know. And when I go into a bookstore, I don't just say a few words. I get up and I do like 30, 40 minutes, and it's fun. It's like a little performance for me. So I get the pleasure of writing it, then I get the pleasure of doing
a little
routine. I don't read. Instead of reading, I convey it in talking, so it's more lively.
And you sign copies.
Yeah, I do that too. And then
who's the publisher?
Random House.
Very
good. And it's funny, you know, signing things is really interesting because when I was signing for the first book, Never Have Your Dog Stuffed.
Great title.
Sorry about these titles. a woman came up to me with a photograph of my stuffed dog, only before it died, before it got stuffed. And that's the only copy of that picture I had.
You had a dog you had stuffed?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry to say.
That's why you wrote the book, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
How did she have a photo of your dog?
I don't know. She was maybe a relative of a relative or something.
What breed did you have stuffed?
Yeah.
Not a Chihuahua.
No. A black Cocker Spaniel. Oh. And it was because I was 8 years old, and when the dog died, my father thought it would be a good idea to take it out and bury it together. So I was sobbing after a few shovelfuls, and he said, well, he didn't know what to do. He was stuck, you know. He said, well, maybe we should have it stuffed, and that way you'll always keep it. And I said, okay. And the guy, the taxidermist, he said, what kind of expression did he have on his face? Could you think of dogs as having expressions? They don't have an emotional life like that. They look like a dog. So the dog came back with this hideous look on his face. And he looked, people were afraid that he was going to leap off this blue pad and bite them. Because he looked sort of real, but fierce, you know. And he was in the living room for a while, and people actually backed out of the living room.
Oh, it kind of creeped me out.
It creeped them out. So it really became an image for me of how I couldn't ever hope to hang on to anything that came my way, whatever it was. Mm. When it left, it was gone. Mm. And so I don't hang on to memories. But it's a lesson that I keep learning over and over again, you know. But that was like the central theme of that whole book, which was really about me trying to learn how to become a person.
How long did you keep the dog?
Everybody's so concerned about this dog. He's gone. Don't worry about it.
Well, I don't know
what happened to him. He's probably
Trigger because
Trigger got stuffed. Yeah, I wonder what happened
museum.
To Trigger.
He's in the museum.
Did he get buried with Roy or something?
He's out there in the museum.
Oh, he's in the museum? I thought that Roy got buried with him or something.
Roy's writing.
I think he was buried with Dale.
Oh, with Dale. Well, I don't know what happened to the dog, but my guess is, after all this publicity, he's on eBay. And I've actually looked for him there, but I can't find him.
I was curious if, since filming Resurrecting, have you done any other film projects?
Yeah, I did. I had this beard for a movie that I'm making with Matthew Broderick. It's called Diminished Capacity. And I play his uncle, and I live in the woods in Missouri. Mm-hmm. And he comes down from Chicago to try to put me in a home because I'm getting old and losing my memory. Yeah. And I'm fighting that. But meanwhile, he's been in a bar fight, and he got hit in the head, and he can't remember anything either.
Well, that's pretty funny.
I
want to
see that.
It's very sweet.
You have two old coots out in the woods.
Walking into trees. No, it's not stupid. It's fun. It's a nice story. And then I'm going to make another movie with Rod in this October. Another newspaper story, only this time I'll be a lawyer.
Based on the Valerie claims.
Well, it's not. It's a similar story, but it's not based
Come
on.
On a cleft.
Yeah, well, is that what he calls it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I'm going to make another movie. I can't remember when. Sometime like September or October, and then I'm going to go to England about the book, and it's just I'm happily worn to a frazzle.
You know, you enjoy writing, but that dates back to when you were doing screenplays.
Oh, even before, yeah.
Do you miss screenwriting and directing?
I don't miss directing at all, and I don't miss screenwriting either, because somebody's always telling you to do something different. You know, it's right. There's somebody who has the talent to put the money together thinks that that includes every other conceivable talent. You know, and it's good or bad, right? I remember in one movie, I did the best I could, and it probably wasn't as good as I could have done, or not as good as somebody could have done. But when the guy who ran the studio came and wanted to tell me how to rewrite it while I was shooting it. Now, here I was acting in it and directing it, and I was supposed to stay up all night and rewrite it. I said, you know, those are probably good ideas that you have. That may make a good movie. But this is the one that we agreed I would do, and I'm willing to go down in flames with it. Well, but you should have seen him blanch at that term, down in flames.
Was that Betsy's Wedding?
It was one of the movies. I don't want to talk about it.
Well, Betsy's Wedding was your last one.
Yeah, I didn't feel like directing after that anymore. But I just got asked to direct a picture about a month ago. I don't even remember what it was. I took it so lightly, you know. I don't really want to do it. I didn't enjoy the time I had on Betsy.
You have more fun being a good guy or a bad guy, because a lot of people remember you fondly as a kind of a good guy. But you want to like being a bad guy? Is it more?
Oh, I've always thought I was just playing people.
Yeah.
And the so-called good guys often were, well, even Hawkeye himself was a flawed character, you know. The smart aleck, a skirt chaser, he drank too much. He always thought he was right, you know. But I guess I covered people with the slime of my amiability, and they just couldn't resist, you know.